To start off, I just wanted to let everyone know that while we're here today is to learn some of the language that we're going to be using, and some of you guys may not be making the calls that we're doing, and the callbacks are on the registration. So when people register for that conference in September, they're going to be checking a box that says, yes, I would like assistance. Then we call them to figure out their needs. So having the right language for those calls, and then also just in general having the right language for when we're at the conference.
How many of you have ever had experience in your lives with someone who's had a disability or an activity limitation? Polio or mom or grandma? I like to know what people have experienced or seen. I ask to know where you are or what you've seen or how you've been exposed. When I start talking about language, and I want you to feel very comfortable with me, I do training a lot, and I have heard everything. In community college, it was in when I was actually in college, but we would go and do lectures in community college and college about human sexuality and disability. At that time, it was in to talk about human sexuality and everything, because, well, it was in the community to start to open up, but also when you're that age, you're a walking hormone, and you want to know everything. And we did, and we got a lot of questions. And so I haven't had any question I couldn't answer, and I don't become offended, because if people don't ask the question, they won't understand or know the answer. And somebody says to me, well, I don't know, and this happens in the class at the university, I don't want to ask because I don't want to ask a dumb question. There's no dumb question, but there's dumb people without answers. And a lot of times what happens is that the things that happen to people are because of the fear of asking. So keep that in mind as I go through the presentation. I just got an email from a health plan, who shall remain nameless, and the department is moving families with kids with significant disabilities into managed care who are in fee-for-service and getting a lot of home care. The state thinks that they're getting too much home care. Now, if you're totally paralyzed and you have to be turned and you have to be fed through tubes, I don't know what too much home care is. The state thinks it's going to save money, and it hasn't advertised this. It's given private contract information to the plans that said you will do this and not making an announcement about it. Those are the things that these folks who have little resources are trying to struggle with. And so you got an opportunity. So as I talk, I'll say a little more than you may have anticipated, but it's in part to have each of you think about what's going on in the communities that you work with, and also to give you the breadth. With that introduction, I want to say that there is no the disabled, and there are no the anything else's. There are no the men or the women. Disability is as different as the person who has it, but it's also broken up. There's no, we say it for the purposes of numbers, because this thing, we probably have about 56 to 58 million folks in this country with some kind of disability. And when we take aging that has activity limitations that they don't quite see themselves as disabled, you get into the 70s if you count all those folks with mild still activity limitations, but they have them. Can't see quite so well, can't, you know, this problem where your arms get really kind of too short, you can't get the newspaper farther away, that's an impairment. Now, we can fix it with glasses, but it's an impairment. And if you don't accept it, or that you're beginning to lose your hearing, then you can't get it remediated quickly, and because you don't believe in that, because of what you believe about disability. My dad's generation was brought up to believe that if you were disabled, you disappeared, you were unable, incapable, and you couldn't actually do anything. Now, I was born, and this was my stepdad, so he didn't know, but when I was born, and I was born with my disability, I have albinism. Albinism has two characteristics to it. The first is you have no pigment, no melanin. Show me your arm. She's light, but look, I make her look good. And during the summer, I get lighter and lighter because everybody else around me gets darker and darker. All I do is burn. If I say the word, in Hawaii, I could burn in 20 minutes because I had no protection. When I was little, they didn't have sunblock. And so I considered my biggest impairment the inability to be in the sun. But my second impairment is visual. I'm legally blind, and it's because of a chromosomal issue. Now, when I was a child, of course, they didn't have chromosomal identification, but today you can identify albinism, and I keep thinking, no doctor's going to tell parents that I know that the kid with albinism can't do anything, because there's no connection between albinism and cognitive impairment. You may have both, but there's no connection. You just may be lucky. When I was born, my parents were told by the doctor that I would have to be taken care of my entire life. I have an IQ of over 125. I have a master's degree, but he took the fact of my disability, and it was a fact, and decided certain other things on his own judgment. So the first thing we have to be very careful about is when we observe a fact, we don't apply a judgment about what can happen with that person. And when I deal with the medical students, I talk about that in terms of genetics all the time. We have to give parents the right information, technically correct. We have to explain it to them, and we have to give them certain information about care. But there's a difference between saying, I'm going to work with you to help define the parameters of your child's abilities, and you'll have to put that child in an institution, which is what used to happen to most kids with developmental disabilities, high-level developmental disabilities. Down syndrome, usually kids can learn to read to the third or fourth level grade, and it is a developmental delay. It's one of the ways that we got that name. Kids with Down will continue to learn throughout their lives. Now, they used to only live to be 17 or 18. Now they live to be in their 50s and 60s, and we found Alzheimer's to be a secondary condition. We didn't know that in the beginning because they didn't live that long. But they learn, and they keep learning, and they keep maturing to a pretty high level. Live in their own apartment, be independent. And those folks are put in institutions because if you had that condition, first of all, you looked funny, and second, you acted funny, so therefore you must be unable to perform. Now, you hear how I keep talking about that perception of performance. Much of our language came from that. Crippled, handicapped, boogered up, spastic. All of these words were words that came from a culture that believed that if you were different, you had a physical condition, a cognitive, and we always put them all together. We always put, if you had something wrong with you, and I remember a veteran from Vietnam saying, I don't think with my legs. He was spinal cord injured due to being shot. And people started talking to him louder and slower. He said, I'm not cognitively impaired. I'm paralyzed. And there's a great difference between one and the other. So one of the things that society, as kids, and the kids who grew up when my dad grew up, didn't see disabled people. They weren't in the community. There were no curb cuts. There were no lift equipped vans. There was nothing to allow folks who were otherwise qualified to be in the community. They were in institutions. And I will tell you a couple of exceptions to segregation for education. But I can tell you that generally, very bright people like my associate director who has mild CP, IQ of over 140, was put in a class with folks with IQs of 60 because she had CP. Everybody with CP was dumb, therefore they were put in classrooms. And she had to go to court to get into regular school. That was the kind of thing that our parents, that was rare, and people disappeared with disabilities all of a sudden began to appear like they came from flying saucers into your front yard because the laws began to change. When I went to school, there were no educational protections. They could have kicked me out at any time, and I would have had no right. I was mildly disabled, but I knew kids who were put in private schools or in institutions during the week so that they could go to a school for the disabled, which was usually less education and less expectation, which they meant. So when I talk to you about language, talking to you that because what we think, and language determines a lot of what we think, determines the values that we have about whatever the issue is, which can determine what we believe, which will determine how we act. And that's why language is so important. When my mother grew up, men were called men and women were called girls. And there's an implication there. Men were in charge and women were always little girls to be taken care of. It was a language issue. And my mother didn't get it, but I didn't want to be called a girl because I was going to be equal. And in fact, I tell people, I said, I got that, but I couldn't get past the disability to fight about the girlness. That is, they saw the blindness first, and then they saw that I was female. But it was, and my dad said that's what it meant. You know, we took care of the gals. We made sure they were, you know, they were a little bit, my dad did say this, you're going to crack me up, he died in his 80s, so you can see that he had quite a lifespan. He said, we believe that, you know, the gals just didn't know how to really take care of themselves. They were flighty and emotional, and but good moms. That's what they were for, having kids and taking care of us. Girl, the implication of girl had a lot to do with the values. Just like in African-American communities in the South, they called African men boys. Had a real impact on what we thought about African-American men. And the language I'm going to talk to you about has the same impact in how you interact with folks. The first thing is, if we act in a way that they feel like they're in control of their situation, they're going to be more likely to be willing to move, not knowingly or unknowingly, into the place that we need to be, okay? To begin with, we have to talk about empowering language and language that doesn't empower. If you're a victim, and people are victims, that's a proper word. At the moment you've been raped or the moment you've had a stroke, you're a victim. You've just had something pretty traumatic happen to you. But you want to move from that spot into being a survivor. And for people who've had strokes, people who have had other kinds of, have had their legs lost, had a leg lost, don't want to be called a victim of cerebral palsy or a victim of rape or a victim of stroke. They want to be called a recoverer, somebody who's recovering. Because if I'm a victim, I never can have control. However, if I'm recovering, I've got something to get through. I've got a challenge to deal with, but I'm in charge of it. See the difference between the ways in which we say things? As we deal with people who come into a conference, many of these people, especially the people we're dealing with, are employed many times. They're whether they're paid or not, they're very well respected in whatever it is they're doing. I was appointed by the president to the National Council on Disability. I've been appointed by the governor for Olmstead-related issues before the committee. I'm the chair of the Olmstead Committee. I helped write the language that became the ADA. I have my master's in business. So what I am is not only the fact that I have to read big print, but all of the other elements of my life. And the folks that you talk to on the phone are not the thing that they're asking for, that they need. That's not the only thing they are. They need that. That's not what they are. But they see themselves, and that's why they're active in this activity, as experts in their own areas, and they are. So the first thing we want to remember is we're not dealing with people who don't have a sense of self and don't know what they need. So we don't want to begin with the assumption that we've got to walk them through. We need to speak to them in the same regard we would a peer. Somebody who we're dealing with who calls us up and says, hey man, I want to get this new program for my computer. And you're the programmer, and so you say, okay, I'm going to ask you a series of questions to help me get to where I'm going. Because I need to know, and IT always does this to me, by the way, because I don't know what they're talking about when they start speaking computer. And I say, okay, let's speak together common English. And so I say that to DHCS too, but it doesn't work. So then they begin to ask me questions, and they just ask them to me as they would any customer, and I answer them as I would to any other department in the school that I have to. They don't say, well, because you're blind, do we need to do this or that? When it comes to the visual part, because everybody knows at my university who I am, they'll say, well, Brenda, are there any additional standards? Because they expect that I know for the programs that we have. And I'll say, well, here's where you would go look, because I'm not a computer tech person, but I do know where you look for the specs for new programs for readability and the use of some of the technologies that you can use voice, you can use your head, you can use a pointer, you can even use your eyes. I can't, but other people can. They can actually move stuff around using the movement of their eyes. But there's certain things you have to put in the software for that to work. So there's this dialogue that occurs is between two peers. One doesn't know all about my field, and I definitely don't know all about IT. So they treat me in the same way they would treat any average user, not someone who is disabled, an average user, just an average user. So the first thing is to see that the people who are going to call you, and most of them will not be consumers of the services that we're working on. Most of them will be advocates. who have disabilities, who know their disabilities, and will know exactly what they need. And unfortunately, will expect you to know exactly what they need as well, because that's part of the access discussion. Don't use the word, "Do you have special needs?" Because for many, if you have a need, it's a need. If some other population has a need, it's a special need. So when you hear about emergency preparedness in evacuating from a school setting, you don't hear that it's a special need. You hear that it's a population-related need because a lot of people need it. However, if there's a person in a wheelchair there, they have a special need. No, they have a need to get out of the building. The way may be different, but the need is the same. There's nothing special about it. So when I went to college, we had, you know, people got married and they got kids. And I remember one of the guys saying, "Well, my wife has all these special needs because she's pregnant." Well, no, she's just pregnant and she has the needs of a pregnant woman. They're not special. They're needs, but they're not special. So special means to a lot of people that it's secondary, that it'll be the second thing they think of, that it's set aside. And we've got to admit that in emergency preparedness planning, people in nursing homes used to be considered, well, there may be damage and loss, but it can't be avoided. As you think that, because they have special needs, then it'll occur. If you believe everybody has an equal need to get out, then you create systems that are designed to do better at getting more people out. Because in a catastrophe, a huge catastrophe, there will be loss. But how you define people as useful or not useful will define, and special and not special, will define how much effort you put into creating a system that is going to work for them. It's going to make it, get them out. And Katrina was a great example of that. More disabled people died in Katrina percentage-wise than non-disabled. Lots of people in nursing homes because they had no provision. Lots of people who couldn't get lift-equipped transportation drowned in their homes because they were special and they didn't have a plan for the special people. So you'll see a lot of people who don't like the word special. So what I would do is, you know, they called you because they saw the statement. So, you know, you're doing your normal phone calling. And you're going to call them, and basically you're going to treat them in the same way that the IT people. "We're from such and such of the conference. We're really pleased that you've decided to come to the conference. We want to make it as convenient as possible for you. You've identified to us that you have the following needs." And then whatever they are. "You need a sign language interpreter. My recommendation is you get sign language interpreters, and I don't know about the breakouts, but you can use interpreters or captioning, and that you work with NorCal, and that you advertise and you invite NorCal." You'll notice that in the California Collaborative there are no deaf people. It's because you can't just advertise normally, but yet they have a lot of the needs that the Collaborative talks about, okay? And when you talk about aging, we had this, and this really struck me. There was this big fight between, well, not a fight. There was a discussion between what are now CBAS, new fish, which used to be the ADHCs. And, well, who's going to pay for the interpreter? Because we've got a deaf person in our CBAS. And the plans backed up and said, "Well, we're not going to do that. We're only doing medical appointments." By the way, they're doing that because we made them in contract. They didn't willingly do it. And this was reported to me, and I said, "Well, they're missing the whole point. As a senior citizen, that deaf person needs the same kind of evaluation as everybody else, and they may be ready for a day program. But all they do, they speak American Sign Language. They can't hear. They're not refusing to learn a language, like the old debate about English and other languages. They can't hear. So if you put a deaf person in a CBAS by themselves, you've just isolated them. Even if somebody pays for an interpreter part of the time, they're totally isolated. The evaluation needs to be about how can we group people who sign together so they can create their own enclave in a day program. See, the problem is different than we have to deal with the interpreter. It's a problem of isolation in the hearing community. And when we're talking about healthcare, that means and aging that I'm going to be put in a nursing home and never talk to anyone from the time I'm put in it, unless my friends and family come visit me. I'll be totally isolated, and all that anybody can talk about is who's paying for the interpreter. So, and the deaf keep being isolated because, well, they don't come. Well, they don't come because they know that there probably won't be an interpreter. So part of what has to be done is to reach out to them through their organizations and say, we want you to come because we know you have people who are aging with specific issues, and it would probably be the director or the health person, and they would need an interpreter. But then what happens is other people hear that that happened, and then you see slowly hard of hearing people and deaf people becoming articulate about their needs. They're isolated, and they assume that they are not invited, while they have really distinct issues. And I would just recommend that there be a couple of interpreters there, because we also need to reach out to NorCal. And the other place is the Greater Los Angeles Agency on Deafness has actually a independent living housing unit upstairs in their building. And it's seniors who are deaf, who are over the age of 65, and they sign to each other. They have bake sales. That's how I learned about it. One of those ladies cooks really good cakes. And they, of course, have the interpreters downstairs for that they can provide for their medical and other needs. But they're not isolated. They're a community. And then downstairs are the younger folks. They get to see their grandkids, their families. And it's a unit of people who have the same interest. And one of them is just communication. So that's in terms of you might. And if you get a deaf person, if you're going to call them, you have to go through the video relay service. And if you know that, that's going to impress them. And I'll find out. NorCal will know the number up here that's used. There are now public and private providers of the video relay service. Do any of you know what that is? Well, there's a thing called FaceTime on this, okay? Apple now has a thing called FaceTime, and it's where you can look at your grandkid or your child, and you can, or your friend, and you can be talking, but you can see each other. And the technology's been there in terms of the face part, but we didn't have the technology to transmit it well. We didn't have the power. Now there is a same technology. We have Microsoft has Link, and it's really cool. It's fast now. You and I can talk and see each other and do documents. Well, there's video relay, and how video relay works is there's two screens, a large one, and then a little smaller one, which can be expanded or reduced. And you call this number, and an interpreter answers the phone, a sign language interpreter. And you say, I need to talk to Mary Jane, who's deaf. This is her phone number. The interpreter calls, or vice versa. Mary Jane can call you, and you'll get this interpreter on the phone saying, this is interpreter 755. I'm from the relay service, and this is what I do, so that people understand, because most hearing people haven't used it. She calls a deaf person, and she already knows Mary, probably. This is Sandra, Mary. I'm working today. I'm interpreter number 455. I have Jack on the phone from the collaborative, and you send in a form, and he needs to talk to you. So then you just go back and forth. The interpreter is just an interpreter, doesn't do anything but flat interpret. That's how the deaf people like to communicate. They used to use TTYs, but that's very slow. Spelling's bad, and when you get the wrong prescription, it's not a good thing, because you misspelled it, or the relay service misspelled it. Now you can check it. You can actually say, is it this one or that one? So knowing that will make points with the community. Talking to NorCal will make points with them. And they are their own world. They don't want to be disabled either. That's why I mean there isn't the disabled. They don't want to be in a wheelchair. They definitely don't want to be blind.
Now, on the video relay thing, I don't need to have a...
No, you don't need anything. You just pick up your phone, call the number.
And they have the video connection.
They do.
They can see.
They don't
each
see
other,
you.
The signing.
They see.
Yeah.
You can do that in your office, but you don't have to. No, this is just you call on your regular phone, and they do the work. And it's really great for calling into your doctor as a deaf person. The doctor doesn't have to have anything, but then you can say, "Yeah, my baby's sick." Before it was very difficult. You had to go through a relay service. It was very slow and painful for the doctor. This is a much better system. It's also used in emergency rooms. You know, babies never come on schedule. So the hospital says, yeah, we'll order an interpreter as soon as the baby's due. Well, it's going to come when it comes, and it isn't going to wait for 2 hours for the interpreter to get there. So they now have large screens with the interpreter that can then communicate with the deaf person, but it isn't a total solution. It's flat, which doesn't give it the full 3D body signing. But also, if you're kind of stoned, it's hard to focus on the TV set, so that you really need a live person when it becomes a critical issue. So that's the first one. If you deal with deaf people, you really want to know about the relay service, and I'll help you get NorCal, and I'll help you get the information. It's an important message, because if we're really talking about dealing with the needs of these programs, the Medi-Cal program, what we call seniors and persons with disabilities, and the duals are not the non-disabled population, with a few disabled people being transferred into a system. All of these people are disabled, but yet we tend to just kind of trip over and ignore, the department likes to do it a lot, the needs that will make it possible for this to succeed, and how to build trust with the population that before just really didn't get a lot of the things they needed. That's why the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's why lawsuits. The second is, a person calls you, same thing. I'm calling you because you said that you need an alternative format, and it'll say Braille, large print, audio. What we need to know is, when you talk to them, is, okay, you've told us that you have low vision or you're blind, and you need, and if they need large print, you want to ask them what size font. Because when you lose your vision, it isn't like you all lose it the same. Some people, I use 14 to 16 point, which is not really big as far as some blind people go. Once you determine that, it's also important to ask them if they are a computer user or not. Because if they're a computer user, then we can email it to them. Mm-hmm. And if you use really large print, you can use an iPad, make it as big as you want, and go through it without 10,000 pieces of paper. And a lot of low vision people are getting iPads, because iPads and the other tablets that are coming out, that's what I use it for. Typically when I'm in a meeting, I'll be sitting here typing, and the person behind me three tables can see when I'm typing, because I'm sitting, I don't want to be on top of the screen, so I'm sitting back, so it's 28 point. So I can read it just sitting back like you would read it, so everybody else can read it. If you ask that question, then that means that when I get the call saying we need this and this and this, I can email out to those folks who have low vision who want to use large print, whatever size they want, or they can do that themselves. I can say, okay, how big do you want it for transmission? And they'll say, well, just so I know what it is, make it 14 point, and then I'll do whatever I want. That's what I do. If you send me stuff, I make it as big as I want. If they're not a computer user, then you need to make that note so that I can then say, okay, what size do you want? And this is always the tough part, and I'm one of the worst abusers of this because I never have time, is try to get the materials as quickly as you can. If I have 3 weeks, I can mail this stuff to their home overnight or even two-day mail so that they've got it in advance and can take a look at it. For the packet stuff, well, that's meant to be handed out, so we have a little more time. But we still needed enough time to get it done and for you to get it packaged into it. And it takes a little time to do all of this. If they say they want audio formats, all you need to do is tell us audio. And we have software. And it's real important you don't give us PDFs, because most old PDFs are pictures. And the screen readers and the print readers can't read them. That they look like a picture. But their new PDF program is designed to be read. It's designed not to be able to be messed with, which is the goal of the state and the goal of, you know, people who own the material, but it can be transmitted into text or into audio formats. And there's actual software that speaks Spanish and English. They've just added German, Chinese, and Japanese. We only do Spanish and English. That will go through and make that audible, and it'll do it in about a tenth the time it would take for a reader to do it. So say 3 pages takes 20 minutes versus a reader who 3 pages could take an hour because they have to modulate themselves and make sure it's properly done. And it speaks very well, and you can actually get different voices. So say you have an older person who's hard of hearing and can't see well, and they've got a pitch issue, we can actually take the pitch down, because usually you lose your hearing in the higher pitches, or we can take it up. If they need Braille, don't panic. We don't make Braille just because. It's very voluminous and relative to the population, very few people use it. But if you send me the tech stuff, we can get you Braille within 7 days. Now, after July, we'll be able to get you Braille a little faster because we're getting our own printer because of our own school. But we have to send it out, and we tend to send it out to Junior Blind or Braille Institute.
So Brenda, on the person who needs it in an audio format, so we can convert or get our speakers to send us things
text
in a
is
Word,
nice.
Or
it's
text
nice.
Or Word. And
or the most recent version of PDF.
Well, my like Jeff Tom, I don't think his reader can, or there are very few documents. We haven't gotten any documents that in a PDF format that his readers.
He's probably got
to,
an old reader, so you need. And we know
so
Jeff is our client. So here's what you do with Jeff: is you say to Jeff, Jeff, you need it to be read. Do you want audible or do you want it on computer? Because Jeff also has his own screen reader. It's called JAWS.
Mm-hmm.
He works for the legislature.
So far, he's used, everything's been in Word
and
format.
That's
it's
what
fun.
Jeff wants. He's like me. You know, we work, so we figured out how to make it work for us. And I know Jeff uses JAWS all the time. His software may not be the most updated PDF stuff because the latest one that came out was only like about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
My approach to that is just to make, and we tell doctors this, make a notation about what the best thing is for your patient, write on the patient record. If it's hard, if it's a deaf person, you need an interpreter. When the reservation comes in, you know, when they call to make an appointment, make sure that pops up and it says blind or deaf, needs interpreter. So that then the receptionist knows immediately, call up and make it happen because the plans pay for that in many, many cases. So we've helped, so thinking about knowing your client, and we're going to be with Jeff forever. Jeff is really engaged on this.
Right.
So you would just know what he needed. And as a reg, so for example, by his name, you should have electronic, you know,
mm-hmm.
send electronically. And by mine, you should send electronically because then you know, okay, those two want it that way. And that would mean everything that you would produce, you'd send us the agenda and the packets in advance, and we'll make them the size you want. And you don't even have to mess with them. Or if you send me one and say we have a new client and they want it in large print and they want it hard copy, then we can take care of it. We have little codes we use. L for large print.
Yeah, we've been able to handle those so far okay. But I did, I ran into somebody at the Health and Human Services Agency who just assumed everybody had this new reader. And
they don't.
Well,
for blind people, it's very hard. It's expensive. In fact, a lot of blind people have older computers, or all of their memories being taken up with all the special
right.
technology they have to read the stuff. JAWS takes up a lot of memory. So if you don't have a lot of
pretty
memory,
amazing.
You can get eaten up by JAWS. If you have a new computer with 500 million gigabytes, then it's okay.
Was that a bad joke? You could be eaten up by JAWS?
I laughed at
yes.
it.
Yes.
I'm glad I was listening.
He got it.
I like the notation of using codes, L for large print.
B for Braille.
Yeah.
We're pretty simple about
yeah.
our codes. There's nothing secret about them.
And it's just easier. Am I following you correctly when you're saying, after we call and ask this person the best way to help them, it's something that we can continually use for them?
If they come
I still
all
check
the time.
In, but, yeah.
Well,
if it's someone like that is in the collaborative we work with a lot. Like,
yeah. I mean, if it's a new member, that is, if somebody that doesn't come to your stuff, but they're coming to the conference, you won't know. And they may not show up again. But if you have, if you're keeping a list, because you're going to mail back for another event, still put that little code on that list.
Yeah.
You know, if you're having a conference and you say, well, we want to keep the list, we want to build a list, it's easy to put a little code on there that says, we know this person's going to need large print. And then when you
right.
call me, you can say, okay, this is what we're expecting in terms of numbers because these people, and you don't always, you know, you can always call back. They'll feel good. It's like any business. If you make what we call high touch, that is where you call and talk to the person personally, it makes you feel really special. I have a Hilton timeshare. And every year they call me up and wish me a happy birthday. Now, I know why they're doing that, but it still feels okay that they do it.
Yeah.
And Southwest always sends me a birthday card. That's how much I fly. You have to fly a lot to get a birthday card.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm going, okay, they treat me differently for because I spend so much money with them. But people feel like, okay, these people, and this is not about disability. This is about human nature. But we tend to talk about people with disabilities. We tend to talk to other people about them. We tend to think about, well, how are we supposed to do this instead of just doing it? One of the questions I always get asked is, I mean, every class I teach, well, what if I'm watching someone and I see that, or I believe they need help? What would you do? Come on, guys.
Offer.
Well,
and I like to tell a story, and I saw this, I had a woman tell me this story, and that's why I like to tell it. She said, I was getting out of my, because I lectured, I did the same, you know, ass thing, and she raised her hand, and she says, I know the answer. And I said, you do? And this was like 100 people in the class. She says, I'm, about 5 years ago, I had a, you know, my baby was 2 years old, just wait. And he wanted to run everywhere, and I had to keep control of him, because I didn't want him to run in the street. And I got out of the car, and I picked up the 3 bags of groceries, and I was trying to hang on to his hand, and all of a sudden, this man came running at me. And she said, I freaked out because I thought he was trying to get me or my baby. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, he stopped suddenly as though he'd had a thought, probably from looking at my face. And then he said, I'm sorry. Can I help you? Because he was afraid she was going to drop something or lose the baby because he was trying to get away because he was 2 and he wanted to go, you know, anywhere but with you. And I said, that's right, he asked you. I said, if he'd been standing in the next lawn and just said, hey, Mary, I see you're having a problem. Would you like a hand? You wouldn't have been afraid. She said, no, I probably would have given him my firstborn at that point. And so the important thing is to ask the person. I mean, imagine yourself, and this happened to me. I used to live on Beach and Edinger in Huntington Beach, and that is a 6-way light. And for people with low vision, 6-way lights are, like, not nice because you don't know where the cars are going to come. You can kind of do a 4-way light, that's okay, you know, 2-way light, but 6 is really scary. So I had to cross it twice a day, every day, to get to the bus to go to work. And what happened one day is I got across, it was Friday too, and we were going to happy hour. A bunch of us were getting together at happy hour. So I was very preoccupied. I'd gotten across the street, I was still alive, I was going to the apartment, get ready and go to happy hour. And this guy grabbed me and pulled me across the street because he thought that's where I was going. I was ticked. And I explained to him that I just gotten across the street and I didn't want to have to do it again today, so he was going to walk me back. Because it was stressful for me, but I had the skills to do it. And so asking, pushing somebody from the back, they could be pushing themselves, you can scrape them, their hands, not opening a door unless the person either asks you or you ask the person if it's okay. And there's a lot of reasons for this, and personal space being one of them. But also, there's a big difference between somebody who's 18 years old and just became paralyzed and needs to prove to themselves they're still a full person, they can do everything they need to do, and somebody who's 40 who's been paralyzed for a long time and says, hey, my shoulders hurt, you are welcome to open the door. You know, I already know I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
So just the personalities of people on the bell-shaped curve, from very sweet, nice people to very mean, nasty people, well, they're disabled people on all levels of that. There are people who have accepted their disability who are comfortable with needing help. There are people who still have to prove themselves. I have a senior manager, and he is 78 years old, and I adore him. But he will not accept that he has a significant disability. He has major nerve damage in one leg due to aging and due to back surgeries, and he has fallen frequently, but he refuses to use a scooter. Now it's becoming to the point where he's going to have to. But I see the struggle in him to remain able-bodied. He's not able-bodied, but he sees himself as becoming all of a sudden, because he sits in that scooter, unable to do things. He sees himself that way. So we've worked very hard to get him not to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real to him. So when we offer help, we have to know, where is that person at in their own psychological man's position about what they're doing? And then there's people like me who just crossed the street and we really didn't want to be on the other side. So it's really important to ask. And that's you know, you get somebody who says it's a quad, like Mike. Mike needs help all the time. So he usually brings an attendant, but he has a service dog. And so when he does come to Homestead and he's by himself because he let his attendant have a break, basically, I say, okay, Michael, do you want me to seat somebody by you to help you? So when you need the microphone and the water, and he'll say yes. It's just, it's like any other question you might have when you see somebody and you say, I think that person wants coffee. Well, you know, spring it.
Yeah.
Go over and say, do you want cream and sugar in it too? Yeah. So if you think that somebody looks like they may need assistance throughout the project, whatever it is, you can ask. And I said to Mike, I said, Mike, is he really good at picking up pencils? Because I noticed that I said, because that person keeps dropping theirs, and I'm afraid he's going to, like, give it to you. And he starts laughing. He said, he actually did that. He actually picked up her pencil and gave it to me. Because the dog's been trained to pick up pencils. So it's if something looks like you need to just get more information, it would be like any other meeting you would be in or any other encounter, inquire. Now, does that mean everybody will be nice to you? Probably not, because some people aren't nice. But mostly people will give you, especially the groups you're going to be working with, will give you good information and tell you what they need. A newly disabled person is different than a person who's been, we like to call it around, because they have to learn what they can do. Remember I said there's no the disabled. If there's nothing else you learn when you walk out of this room, when you look at somebody that has some kind of activity limitation, they're not like anybody else. So we have to begin with that assumption. But if we treat them with courtesy and don't call them things that imply inability and don't talk down to them and don't yell at them, you're probably going to do all right. We all hate that. Well, I used to have a deaf friend, and he said to me, whenever you're with me, people like to put papers in my face. I said, that's nothing. They yell at me. Because if you're blind, you can't hear. If you yell at her, you'll see better. And it happens to us all the time. So we have to say to people, no, I hear quite well. You don't have to yell. And it's truly true. It gives you a headache. If people can't speak, that doesn't mean they can't hear. Sometimes it's cancer, the throat, and people yell at them. So we have to think about our behavior in that sense. This isn't, I have to know who this is. I have to have information to be able to do my job, whatever that is. So I'm going to ask the questions in the same way I would ask questions for information about a bill I'm reading or a group of customers that are coming in. I do a lot of graduation work. We don't assume anything with those students. We ask. And it has nothing to do with disability. We just need to have all the information to make the whole project go smoothly. And we're graduating. This year we're graduating like 800 people. So lots of questions, lots of communication to make sure we get the parents in. If they don't speak, if we've got to have language interpreters, if we have to have captioning, we just know that we have to ask. Don't feel afraid to ask the questions.
Yeah, and I guess it's more like I'm okay asking the questions, but I mean, just thinking back on how I framed some of those questions may not be the right asking. Not saying, can I help you with this, or is that okay, or is it just...
I would say, is there anything I can do?
Is there anything?
It's not that hard. If you're as a planner, a coordinator, you're thinking, this person's on the phone, and they're saying they're in a wheelchair, and they need to come in early because their wheelchair's big. That means you probably have somebody who's very impaired, that is physically, that they have a significant disability. It also may be somebody who's I don't know if you've seen Mike. He has a big wheelchair. He's totally paralyzed. He uses a sip and puff to move his wheelchair around. So if somebody says something and you think, that may mean more, the thing, as they say on the airlines, is there anything else I can do to assist you? It's the same language you would use for anybody that you were trying to assist. So she says to you, I have a big wheelchair, I need extra room, and I need to get in early, and you go, fine, no problem, we're going to let folks in who need to, we'll move some chairs. Is there anything else I can do? Because, in fact, you're thinking, boy, I wonder if she's going to have somebody there with her, is she going to have other assistants? Instead of asking, well, do I need to help you to the bathroom, you just say, is there anything else we can do to assist you? And then she may open up and tell you because you asked it that way. It's the same as the operator says, only they mean, is there anything else we can sell you, when AT&T asks you if they can help you when you're buying a phone. When they say that, I think, you just want to sell me 5 more things. But I appreciate that you're asking. So that's kind of when we think about the question, think about how you would ask anyone. And pretty much it's going to be the same. If someone says, for example, that they are going to need help with food, and that may happen. You get somebody who has a quad or who's using 2 canes and has no place to balance what it is. The best thing to say is, and then this is a staffing issue for you too, is having enough people. And there are always people in our community who do for each other, so that's not an issue. Again, is how would you like me to help you with your food, with getting your food? And some people will say, I don't like this and I don't like that. Can you bring it to the table? Because they're paralyzed. And other people will say, well, I'll go with you and point out what I want. So you give them the option of how they want to do it. Because some people are very picky and some people aren't. Some people eat everything. They don't care. But they'll tell you. And then other people will say, well, I'm allergic to glutens or something, and you'll have to know what that is. But most people will either go with you and just point or tell you, I'd like that and that and that. That's what my associate June does. She's in the scooter, she can carry it, but it's still, she's here and some of the food's here, and that's part of the issue too. I don't know how if you're gonna have a food event. Lunches then.
We have boxed lunches.
That's perfect.
And definitely ask you beforehand if they're vegetarian.
Right.
They do.
That's
have,
normal.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're disabled.
Right. But when we're doing the callbacks, asking if they would like assistance during lunch.
Yeah, and tell them what it is, boxed lunch. Now,
yeah.
What happens when it's a buffet is, unless it's all flat, you have it on a table and it's flat. See, if you're in a wheelchair, this is your reach. So when you put things up here, then even a paraplegic can't get it because it's up here. So the best way to design your table, maybe have a little more table, but you don't have to worry about it because it's boxes, so that you can sit in a chair and you can reach the item you need and you can do it.
But
you're doing the other is rotate it. So have a place where you have fruit, Danish, whatever the other thing is, and then reverse it so you've got some of each item on the lower level, which will mess with blind people, but that's okay. And some of each item on the upper level. Now, a blind person asks you for help. Typically, what the blind person wants you to do is to take them through it and to describe the stuff. And even I'll do that from time to time. Some of these buffets, it's all gooey stuff, and it's different colors, and it's poor lighting, and I'll think, well, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll usually say to somebody ahead of behind me, what is that? And they'll tell me. Because they'll have these itty-bitty, teeny-tiny little signs. But I'm not going to get my head into the food to read it. So it's important to just, if somebody says, "May, you know, I need some help," and again, how can I help you? And the blind person will usually say, "Can you guide me through and tell me what it is, and I'll tell you what I want." Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes they can't see it. And they know what they want. They know how to do it, and they're pretty fast movers.
So ideally, we know some of these things ahead of time that people would like assistance with the food.
Then you can figure
things.
Out your staffing
yeah.
issues. And there are people, I mean, I'd be happy to help. There are people who will volunteer to do that. And there are people who've done it a long time. I've worked with June forever and ever, and I know exactly how to walk through a food line with her. Just because we've done it forever. It's kind of like being married. You just figure it out because you've been together. And I've been doing it for like 20 years with her, so I even know what she hates, and then I try to give it to her. Just to make her mad at me. Are there other questions?
Definitely going to ask the catering company to provide a little bit extra staff.
That's a good way to
break.
Do it that way.
Also, should I be concerned that they should maybe, if I share these notes today with them, so they
you
have
sure
a little
can.
Better
I'm
understanding
happy to answer
of our
any question they have, too. Most we encourage hotels to train their staff. Hotels are doing better about training their staff who have people living there. I mean, you know, spending the night. We had an incident with the senior transportation consultant to the Secretary of Transportation was in Washington. His name is Richard DeVilder. He's a very good friend of mine. I've known him forever.
Oh, I
you know Richard. He's limbless,
yeah.
Totally limbless. And just loved to show his picture in his bathing suit and ask medical students what he can do. He can do a lot, but the first thing you think is he can do nothing unless you know people with disabilities and you know Richard. And so when he came to the Holiday Inn, when he got appointed as deputy director of rehab, he stayed at the Holiday Inn, and he said to them, "You guys need to train these folks because they're uncomfortable working with me, and I don't want them to be uncomfortable. I'm going to be here for 2 months." So they had a great training, and he did it. And then, of course, now when he comes in, his favorite pen to type with, he uses voice recognition, but he also uses a pen to type with, is a Holiday Inn pen. And it's because the tip is the top is very soft, and so he leaves the top on, and then he types for his teeth to hang on to. And he tells the story. He says, after that training, well, everybody was very comfortable with what I needed. And he had an attendant in the morning, but a couple times the attendant was sick, and boy, no problem. Staff was willing to do anything. So it's just a comfort level issue. And he tipped well. I need to mention that he tipped well. And we tell people with disabilities, you have a responsibility too. Thank you is very important. So it's a both kind of way thing. Now I would train them and have a few extra because that works really smoothly because the helpers then can go around and help you with coffee and things like that, and then the meeting goes on. You get a group of high school kids who have belonged to a club or a group of college kids that have belonged to a club and you have them do it. It's a good educational tool. In Oregon, we have a campus in Lebanon, Oregon now. And, it, you know, every place is different, and Oregon is definitely Oregon. The Oregonian, well, their Boy Scout troops love, and Girl Scout troop loves to do volunteer work and disability programs. So when we had graduation, they were the people who helped Grandma, or the start school, rather, convocation, Grandma and Grandpa and all the folks who needed assistance to get in and out of the facility. And those kids were so well-mannered, and I said, well, did you provide training? They said, yeah, we brought in people with different disabilities, and they lectured the kids about how to behave and good manners, and those kids were great. It was amazing. So sometimes that's a good way to create awareness and take away stress for the staff. And then they get a badge. At our university, we have two rooms that hold 330 people. Class, they're huge auditoriums. They're connected electronically. If we get 700 people, we just move them into the next room, and we have the screens so that we can serve them. So our view of larger is better is to say, let's make sure electronically. So one of the ways, if this succeeds as much as it could, let's find a venue down south, and let's have the opportunity for speakers to be seen in both places and then facilitators in both sites. Our approach is to say, okay, there's a couple ways to, and make sure there's captioning and all the stuff I make them do. Let's make sure that we know what our goal is. And we can do that way, which is a tech way, or we can have the conference in two places and have the speakers in two places at two different dates. Because we have to do convocation that way. We can't beam me up, Scotty, has not happened yet. As I pointed out to the president. But I want them all together. Well, we can't do that. They're in Oregon. So we've done the... We will fly, we will do ours, and then we will fly up there and do theirs. So another approach is to think about the conference if it grows in two places, mm-hmm. south and north.
That's a great idea.
You could do a second conference in L.A., and you don't have to do it in L.A. You can do it in Burbank. You can do Ontario. Ontario has a beautiful airport that LAX keeps strangling. They own it, and they've got some nice hotels, and they've got that are cheaper. Mm-hmm. And the traffic is better, and we're there. We would offer up the university space if you wanted to use it. We have the big rooms, and we have all kinds of rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So there are places you could have it there that are cheaper. The bad side about L.A. is there is no real public transportation. I love the Bay Area. I love BART. I'm independent. I don't have to worry. I can go to BART and go anywhere.
The closed captioning.
It's a choice. You can use an interpreter or closed captioning. Now, let me tell you the upside about closed captioning.
Because if you're, I mean, we're talking about a space where we have 300 people and it's...
We use big screens.
Yeah, we'll have two big screens. And these, but don't you think a closed captioning would be better or
Well,
both?
Here's the upside about closed... No, I wouldn't use both.
And then what about for the breakout rooms?
Here's the closed captioning jewel. You want notes? Use closed captioning. You don't need you don't need note taking because
true.
You get it all. And so when we had our trainings, when we had a set of focus groups, when we had a larger meeting, we closed captioned it, not just for the hearing impaired people, because closed captioning, when you're hard of hearing, you don't sign, but you can't hear what's going on. That's really who uses captioning most. Grandma and Grandpa turn on the captioning on the TV. They can still hear, but not well enough. They want to hear, you know, they want to rant and rave at the liberals, and they have to hear what they have to see what they said. But it's a great note taker. That's the good thing. Now, in breakout groups, your problem is for the hard of hearing person isn't as great because they can, as long as people are courteous and be quiet, and they perhaps could have assisted living,
assisted
listening
hearing,
devices,
yeah.
They could hear. The deaf person would need the interpreter in the breakouts, or you can do captioning like this. You have a computer, I have a computer, we hook them up and I just watch what you're typing on a small screen. And a lot of times that's what we use for graduation. We have to do that this year. We're putting a screen in one place. There's three deaf people who are watching their hard of hearing daughter graduate from physical therapy school. So we have it set up for them so they just sit and watch this captioning. It's not giant on the screen.
But we could do that in the breakout rooms.
Yes, you could. Too. You could okay. do that. And that's a great note taker. They will get better reports than they have ever given.
True.
It's expensive.
So with the closed captioning, is that something that I talk to the, you know, the audiovisual people at the convention center,
no,
or you recommend?
Yeah, I'll tell you about captioners, and I'm going to tell you now they're expensive.
I guess we won't really know until after we
register.
But you still need to know the cost, because you're going to have to tell Scan if so. And it's not so much deaf people who will show up, although I'd like you to see if you can get, and if you get one deaf person, use the interpreter. But if you're talking about seniors, see, this is the issue. I am not disabled, but I didn't hear 10% of what was just said. If you use closed captioning for meetings of a large number of seniors, you can assume, especially if they're in their 70s and 80s, that they don't hear everything. And so you're wasting a lot of energy on people who aren't going to sit there and get your information and won't tell you because they don't want to be embarrassed. So as we deal with aging groups, there's two things that I like to recommend. 14 point for everything. They're not going to tell you they can't see, but that little print in the newspaper is just virtually unreadable. I watch my dad go farther and farther. Pretty soon I'd say, Dad, here. And I actually got him a little book thing that you could lay things on, and then he'd sit back like this and read the newspaper. It's but he wasn't disabled, you see. And I didn't do that to him. I just found ways to make it work, like portable headset so he could listen to the TV without me going deaf. I just found ways not to have to have him confront something that was just part of his life forever. So if you have that capacity available, you're going to notice people looking at it and reading it because they can figure out what's going on. A lot of what people think is a diminished capacity is diminished hearing. They're just not listening. Did you get that? The doctor says, oh, yeah, uh-huh. And you know they didn't because they come home, what happened? I don't know. What do you tell you? I don't know. It's an aging issue, and it's something we need to confront without having to make people change. You're not going to make people change their whole life views. Now, we baby boomers are coming up. That's me. And we have a different view of computers and communications and technology than our parents. But we're dealing with some people in this Medicare population we'll be serving who are dealing with, I don't know how to turn on a computer, let alone use it. And I'm not going to be like those people. I'm not helpless. I'm not going to have you take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who will say, no, they don't need your help while they drop the food. So captioning, if you're thinking about large groups of seniors, is something you might think of as a regular thing. But 14 point is also very, very helpful. It just makes it easier for me to, not me, but people who are aging, to see stuff without having to struggle.
And for those that may need it but don't want to speak up about it,
that's
and
right.
then it's there and they can digest the information better.
Now with these new glasses, there's a guy, he's a chemist and he's in Southern California, physicist, and he's actually designing glasses where the glass itself will modify to where if you're trying to look far, it'll modify to the prescription that is given to you. If you're trying to look close, it'll modify to the prescription automatically. They're in experimental stages, but they actually had a set they were showing on TV.
Wow.
So in the future, instead of having bifocals or trifocals or all those things, none of which work for me, you put these on, and if you were looking out to drive, they would focus out. If you're looking down at the speedometer, it would focus in. And I think when it comes, it's going to be a revolution in glasses. Other questions? It was my pleasure to do this with you.
Thanks, Brenda. Very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.